我哋平时饮嘅水都充满咗重金属、杂质、氯气同埋细菌。我会用健波能量活水器，除咗可以清除以上嘅杂质之外，仲可以活化水中嘅信息。健波能量活水器，生命之源，健康之泉。六创意健康店电话2882-4848，网址www.healthshop.com.hk。
以下节目内容纯属主持及嘉宾个人意见，与本台立场无关。
Janet, well, reading your book, I still don't understand why you got cancer. You know, you had a perfectly happy childhood and adulthood. You know, you had a enviable marriage, and you became a grandma, and you didn't have much economic pressure. You know, your family was sort of well off. No pressure, no worries, and you were very healthy in terms of lifestyle. You were vegetarian, and then you do a lot of things under the sun, exercises and everything. You should be the last one to get cancer.
Yes, that's what I thought. Yes, well, I think, you know, that there's many, many reasons why people do get cancer, of course.
You were a normal little girl from New Zealand.
That's right, yes. So, you know, when I was a child, I had a very happy childhood. Mm-hmm. For the majority of the time, I did have two older brothers. So, you know, as a little girl, that can be interesting, to say the least. But nothing, you know, nothing traumatic. And my parents...
You were baptized into any church?
Yes, I was, actually, into the English Christian church, Anglican. And that was just because that's what my parents were, and that's what was done. But my parents were a very, very loving parents. So I was brought up seeing, you know, really unconditional love with my parents. And I thought that was normal. The other thing I experienced was with my mother, she was very spiritual person. So not so much on the religious side, but very spiritual in the way of appreciating nature and appreciating that, you know, the spiritual side of things. That, for instance, just now I saw a butterfly fly by. Well, my mother would have felt that that was a spiritual experience as opposed to just seeing a butterfly. So she knew that there was things beyond what we see. And again, as a child, I thought that was not normal because that was what I experienced as a child and saw. So I was brought up, you know, in that very happy, healthy and spiritual way with my parents. And we lived in a very nice area of New Zealand. And New Zealand at the time was not so busy, if you like. So we were sort of, you know, we had a garden, and my dad used to grow a lot of the food that we ate. And because at that time was just after the Second World War, they didn't have a lot of money, so they couldn't afford to buy a lot of meat or, you know, things that were very expensive. So in fact, our diet was very healthy by default, just because we ate from the garden most of the time, and they couldn't afford to buy, you know, steak or anything. I never tasted a steak until I was in my teens, and I thought it was disgusting. So I just, But when I was about five, my mother, she used to make these stews. So she'd cook all of the vegetables together with a little bit of meat that was usually something like corned beef or something that was not like a very expensive cut of meat. And I couldn't eat it. And when I was about five, I used to sit there, you know, with food in my mouth, chewing, but I couldn't swallow it. And my parents said we all had to finish one meal before we, you know, the first course before we started on the second course. And so my older brothers would be saying, hurry up, hurry up, hurry up, we want to get to dessert. And I just said to my mother, I can't eat this, Mum. You know, and she said the most wonderful thing. She said, so long as you eat your vegetables, that's all that matters. And she never said to me, you don't need to eat meat, but she knew intuitively that I didn't need to eat meat to be healthy. So that was wonderful for me. So from that point on, I was vegetarian. I didn't eat meat. And I ate all the vegetables. My brothers used to give me all their vegetables as well because they didn't want to eat them. So in fact, from that point on, my diet was very good. My mother only made things from, like for instance, when she made bread, it was always from whole grains. Nothing was processed into white flour or white sugar because we couldn't afford it. It was more expensive. It was the more people that had more money that used had those. We never had anything that was processed. We didn't have junk food. All those things came in later in my life anyway, but not later to me, but later in the years that they were available. And so we just didn't grow up eating those things. So we had generally what would be considered a healthy diet and a healthy lifestyle. We did a lot of outside activities. And then when I met Alan in my mid-teens, we decided that we would get married and live together. So we wanted to do that in a natural way as well. So we actually bought land that we wanted to grow fruit trees on, which is interesting now that I'm basically fruitarian all these years later. But we wanted to grow fruit trees and food on the land, which we started to do. And that, you know, that also influenced what we were eating at that time.
Well, what was Alan's profession? How did he make a living with you?
Well, interestingly, when I met him, he was he worked in a timber firm. Sorry, and he was he had qualifications for cutting timber. So he could develop the blades to cut the timber. Mm. So it was a completely random one-off kind of a career. And we met at a dance, so it was sort of not something that, it was kind of unplanned, and we met at a dance and just fell in love immediately, pretty much. And within a year, we were married. But at that point, we decided that we didn't want to just work 9 to 5. I worked at a lawyer's office, you know, and so we wanted...
As a clerk?
I was a legal secretary.
Wow.
And so we just decided that wasn't the way we wanted to live, especially if we started to have children. We wanted to live our lives with our children. And so we looked at, you know, how we could, what kind of a lifestyle we could find that would enable us to all live together rather than our children going off to school, you know, what was considered to be normal. So it was actually Alan who said, well, you know, what about we sail away in a boat and just sail away from all these things and live together on a sailboat? And I had never been in a sailboat. I'd been in a boat once with my grandfather and we'd gone out fishing of all things, and I fed the fish because I was literally vomiting over the side of the boat the whole time. So I was not a sailor. So he had a little boat at the time when I first met him, and we would go out sailing a little bit together. And, you know, because we were so much in love and we so enjoyed being together, that it really actually didn't matter whether we were on a boat or where we were. So it made a difference. to me with being on a boat. And so our dream at that time was to literally, when we had, after we'd had children, when they were old enough, we would sail away with them together, you know, into the sunset, that kind of dream.
That was your early 20s.
Yes, that's right. Yes, I was married. By the time I was 21, I had our first child. And then by the time I was 22, I had my second one. They were very close together. And at that point, we had our land and we had our orchard, which we were developing, and that was, we were doing that together. And as the children got a little bit older, our daughter, who was the oldest, when she was five, then it was time for her to go to school in New Zealand at five. And I just didn't want her to go. I didn't want her to not be with us. And of course, then she had her little brother who was with us. And I thought, no, I just, this isn't right. And so we looked at, you know, the different options, how we could live together. We thought maybe we could just go and live in the land somewhere and live together. But we decided that we would sail away. So we bought and built a boat and literally sailed away.
So that was together. Homeschooling in the middle of the ocean.
That's exactly right. We were very lucky from New Zealand. There's a, you know, a homeschooling that you can get from the school curriculum for people who are not able to send their children to school. Mm. So, yes, our two children, our son and our daughter, were schooled at home on the boat right up until high school years. And then they also did their high schooling as well. But by that time, we'd sailed away, literally sailed away. We were in Europe by then, so we were doing a Europe tour there and living on a different type of boat. And we continued to live together right up until the children were able to, you know, go and do secondary, well, I guess go to university if they wanted to. And so at that point, it was their choice. We felt we had made the choices as to our lifestyle up until that time, and it was up to them. So our daughter wanted to be a marine biologist, because she'd grown up on the water. So she loved animals, and she wanted to help animals, especially those that live in the ocean. Mm-hmm. So we looked at where she could best go to university, and the choices were quite large. At the time, we were living in France, so she could have gone to a very good university there for marine biologists, or Canada, where my family had since moved to, or back to New Zealand. So we went to those three places and looked to see what the options were, and she eventually chose Canada. So then we moved to Canada, where my parents and brothers lived at the time, had moved to from New Zealand. And so we were there for about 6 years, and certainly during the time that our children went through university. And then after that, we went off and did other things as well. But she got her her degree as a marine biologist, and then our son decided he wanted to do a bit more traveling and things like that. So at that point, we were starting to, you know, sort of move a little bit further apart. So we chose at that point to go to Europe and do some other exciting things while the kids were going through their university years, and our son chose to go to Scotland. So we were sort of quite a way apart from each other for those years during their university time. And Alan and I were working a freight boat in the canals in Europe. So that was a, you know, a whole different thing. It wasn't until our daughter got married, which, you know, happened while we were back in Canada for the wedding, of course, but it wasn't until about a year later that she told us that she was expecting our first grandchild, that we decided we needed to be closer to the children again. And so we moved back to Canada, and then we did several years in Canada so that we could be nearby when the grandchildren were being born. And our son, meanwhile, was in Scotland, and then he sailed away, strangely enough. And he was sailing on big ships, the big sailing ships around the world for a while, and it was in Australia that he met his wife. So then we had a dilemma because our daughter and her family were in Canada and our son and his new family were in Australia. So we had to choose and decide what we were going to do there, because at the time we had started, I had had my cancer diagnosis, and because from that we had started up a wellness centre in Canada, and we did that for 6 years. And then during that time, though, each year we were having to go to Australia to be with our son and his family, and we just decided to move there at the end of the 6 years, and our daughter and her family came with us.
And so how did the cancer come up in the first place? You seem to attribute that to two accidents.
Yes, that's right. It was an environmental situation for me, and in actual fact for most people it is an environmental situation that creates the problem, you know, where cancer does start to mutate, the cancer cells start to mutate, whether it be environmental from the outside or from the inside of the body. So for me, it was definitely being in the wrong place at the right time. And there were two situations where I was exposed to very high toxic levels of substances that caused that mutation to start. Hmm. And that's in the book. It's also in my second book, which I wrote later on, 10 years later. So yeah, it was really those two situations for me. And so it became very obvious to me that I needed to lower my toxic load. And most people have a much higher toxic load than they realize, because we're always being exposed in some form. For me, it was, you know, a very high concentration at the time. So
what happened exactly?
Okay, so what happened? All right, so when we were in Europe, we were there in France, working in France at the time of the Chernobyl nuclear accident. And when it actually happened, the toxic nuclear cloud that was formed from the accident came in our direction. So because of the climatic conditions, it came and swept over the part of France that we were. It was actually quite a scary thing, because people at the time didn't know what was happening, but basically during the daytime things went very dark, and it was literally, you could see a very dark cloud it wasn't a cloud, it was just the whole sky was kind of a greenish brown colour. So it was very scary, because nobody at the time knew what it was, but that is what it was.
You were in your late 30s.
Yes. Mm. And then after that, that was after the first accident. So the first accident where I was exposed to a high toxic level was while we were still in Papua New Guinea. We had been sailing around the world in our sailboat with the children. We ended up in Papua New Guinea and we lived there for several years. Mm. And during that time, we still had our sailboat, but we had decided that, you know, towards the end of that time there, the 6 years, we were going to sell the boat there and move to Europe to do our inland waterways thing. And so while we were there, we decided to get the boat ready for selling. I was painting the boat with a very highly toxic paint. It's called antifouling, which you put on the bottom mm-hmm. of the boat to stop creatures from chewing on the bottom of the boat. And we had the boat up on a slipway, and what we didn't know was that during the night some people came and took some of the chocks out, or the pieces that mm-hmm. were holding the boat up there, mm-hmm. To use it on something else. I guess they mm-hmm. thought it was okay. But I was walking around on the deck with the paint in my hand, the paint pot in my hand, ready to do the painting, and the whole scaffolding that the boat was on collapsed. So everything fell, including me. So I fell about 18 feet onto the ground with the pot of paint in my hand, which ended up all over me. So as you can imagine, as you're tumbling down through the air, the paint just poured all over me, head to foot. So I was completely coated, all my skin, my hair, it went in my eyes, my nose, my mouth, through in my ears as well. And it was probably the highest level of toxic paint that you can possibly have. And that, I was injured as well. So I was rushed to hospital, and I had, the worst injury was to my arm where I hit the ground. But that aside, the worst thing about the whole accident was the fact that I was covered in this very high toxic paint, and that of course goes in through the skin. And even though it, you know, a lot of it was taken off my body at the time, it had already seeped in. They wanted to use a really high toxic liquid to take it off, and I didn't want to do that. I knew right then that I was in big trouble, but we just tried to get as much of it off by wiping it off as we could. And it took about 3 months before my skin actually started to show its natural color. So it was gray from the paint. So that was the first accident. The second accident was being, you know, in having that outfall from Chernobyl. And so it was, you know, the two things really was, I guess, just too much compromised my body enough for it to just start that whole cancerous thing happening. The reason why we know, going back to that time, is because when the when they looked at the cancer cells, they could see how long it had been mutating for, and it pretty much put it right to those dates. So that was what we put it down to at the time.
Mm-hmm. So looking back, how are you feeling? Well, to people like us, you know, we thought that this is providence, and the heavens would want you to spread the raw gospel, and you have to go through all this torturing. And well, you are living with gratitude, but then it is not easy.
Yes, that's right. It's interesting that you should put it that way. But when I had the diagnosis, after the initial shock as to why me, it was, you know, instantly I thought, okay, this is a challenge, and this has been literally sent to me for a reason. Mm. And I did believe that, you know, I could immediately, I sort of thought, okay, I'll get through this, and then I'll have a story to tell.
Mm.
And from, you know, changing, making different lifestyle choices and seeing the difference by, you know, basically leading by example, that is the best way to let other people know how, you know, they can make those same choices if they get in that situation. So I immediately felt that I had sort of, if you like, been chosen. Mm. When I looked at the statistics of how many people, I think it was like 1 in 9 at the time for breast cancer, and I looked at the females.
One woman in 9, yeah, will get the diagnosis of cancer sometime in their life.
Yes.
That's for the Western white,
yes,
people.
But that was at the time. Mm. Now it's 1 in 2.
You mean worldwide or just Western white people?
Well, that was generally what I don't... They never specified, but sort of just on the cancer, you know, the cancer level of, you know, their research and everything else, what they came up with at the time, it was 1 in 9 for breast cancer. And so I counted the amount of women in my family, and there was 9 that were able to get cancer at the time. So I figured I was 1 in 9.
You and mean there was cancer or breast cancer?
Yeah, breast cancer. So no. Yeah, but unfortunately, on that topic, now it's down to 1 in 2, which tells you immediately that whatever they've been doing in those 16 years since I had a diagnosis of, and at that time 1 in 9, whatever they've been doing isn't working. So, you know, all the so-called research that they're doing, their search to cure cancer, is going in completely the wrong direction. Because clearly, if we can go from 1 in 9 to 1 in 2 in that same amount of time, then it's not the way to go. The other thing is that, you know, there are many studies out there, and won't go into the actual studies and so on, but I can give that information at another time. But there are studies from that time till now that have shown that the treatment that is offered, especially chemotherapy, there's basically more people dying of the treatment than there is of the cancer. And in fact, you'd be better off to do nothing at all. You'd have a better chance of survival than if you had to do the treatment, because the treatment is so severe that people are dying of the treatment. However, the information that comes out is not the truth. The information that comes out tells you that they die of cancer, but in truth, it may not necessarily be the cancer that they first had. The other thing, one of the things they told me was that I had a 4% chance of survival from the if I had the chemotherapy.
4%.
It's not very big, is it? Like, seriously, would you even choose that? But anyway, that was at the time. It was 4%. Now, I don't know what they're saying now, because clearly, if it's gone from 1 in 9 to 1 in 2, you've probably got no chance of surviving, especially the chemotherapy. And the research that's being done, the majority of the research that actually is being done, is to find out how much more chemotherapy they can give to a person, or, you know, what amount, I should say, of chemotherapy, or they're designing more lethal chemotherapy than they ever had before, to figure out how much they can actually give you without killing you, so that the longer they can keep you alive giving you these treatments, basically the more money they make. So it's a cancer industry. It's a sickness industry. It's not only just cancer, but everything in the allopathic medical system is designed to keep people alive, sick and alive. Well, if you can call it alive. But to me, I feel, and I know for sure, that most people are spending their lives dying instead of living. And certainly those that are in a situation where they're taking these various treatments, they're taking various pharmaceutical drugs to remedy whatever their health issues are, or what they're diagnosed with, whether it be cancer or something else, they're not actually looking, again, like we said before, at the cause. Why have they got these diagnoses in the first place? Let's eliminate the cause. Rather than treat the symptoms. And while we're treating the symptoms, we're just putting money right back into that sickness industry's pocket. And it's not giving us very good numbers of survival from that point of view. So for me, it was just an obvious choice. And to, you know, go in a more natural way. And what I tell people today is, don't wait for the diagnosis. Look to prevention, look to, you know, your lifestyle choices, what they've been, how they could create the situation they may be in or may not be in yet, or they haven't been told they're in yet. Make the changes towards a more healthy, conscious lifestyle, and maybe we can completely eliminate the need for treatments, or not the need for, but the being offered these various treatments that really are just a way of keeping us more sick for longer.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Well, Jeanette, you know what? You are just the opposite of what I thought people would get breast cancer. You are blowing away my theory. My theory is people who keep everything to themselves, people who pretend to be okay, get cancer. You know, but you, yeah. Obviously, this is not your profile.
No.
You see my point?
Yes, absolutely.
And secondly, for breast cancer, my statistics and my conviction is if you have not properly used your breasts as a mum,
mm-hmm.
You have a much better chance of getting breast cancer.
Yes.
That is statistically valid, I think. But you are just the opposite. You are a happy mum. You did your breastfeeding happily and enjoyed it. So breast cancer should have nothing to do with you.
Yes, that's right. Well, once again, I guess I was chosen. But, you know, as I said, you know, we're pretty much 99.9% certain that the cause of my breast cancer was from, you know, outside of the environmental situations outside of my control. So because I already had somewhat healthy life to start with at that point, I think that was a big help towards my my recovery, just because I was already in that situation. For people who have not been living a healthy life and then, you know, get a diagnosis of cancer, and certainly the breast cancer, and as you said, the high majority, and studies have proved this over and over again, the high majority of women who are diagnosed with cancer, it's from emotional stress. And that's, you know, everything that we have in the way of emotional stress goes to the breast, or, you know, basically we take it to the breast. And that's why, you know, the mutation starts happening in the cancer cells that are held in the breast. And it's not surprising that the majority of people that get breast cancer are women. Men certainly do get it as well, but the high majority is women. And most women are caregivers. It's just our role in life, you know. So we're caring more for others than we are for ourselves, pretty much most of our lives. And I think that I actually did, for my book, Raw Can Cure Cancer, I actually did a lot of research with 64 different women who had a diagnosis of breast cancer, varying different forms of different levels of stages of their breast cancer as well, also coming from different backgrounds, different cultures, different countries, and that was all brought together in the book. So not specifically who, why, what, how, when, but brought together into the one character that goes through the story in the book. And so it was all based, it was based on my story, but also on 64 other women. And one man who had been diagnosed with breast cancer, so that I covered as many situations, if you like, in the book as I could for, you know, for one person, so that everybody has different reasons, different lifestyles, different situations that can cause cancer. And I wanted to bring all those different situations in, not just mine. Because I do get a lot of people saying to me, okay, so what was the treatment, you know, what was the therapy that you did? Because I want to do that. Mm. And I said, well, you're not me. You need to look at your lifestyle. What's, you know, where have you come from? What has caused your situation? And how can you best deal with that? You can certainly deal with it by making the first and obvious choices, and that's to eat the most nutrient-laden food, which is raw fruits and vegetables. But also, you know, looking at the other conscious lifestyles they need to make in lifestyle choices they need to make in life, you know, getting all chemicals out of their life, getting into a situation where they can live more naturally, and so on, and air, you know, breathing the right kind of air, and doing exercises that can help their inner being, you know, like obviously meditation, yoga, various other different physical exercises that you mentioned, Tai Chi and so on, but those are all things that can help. They're all positive things that can help. So those are the first choices to make right from the start. And then it's looking back at your own lifestyle and your own situation to pinpoint what the cause was and then move from there. And pretty much most people will find that it was an emotional cause. Mm. And that's why a lot of people say to me, well, how could you get breast cancer? You've always had a happy life and so on. But mine was, you know, the one in a million, I guess. I shouldn't have, by looking at it, as you said, you know, you shouldn't have got breast cancer, but I was in a situation that I was not in control of. But what I found, what was really interesting, was that I found that I still had choices that I could make that would make a difference. I wasn't in the perfect situation anyway with the choices that I had been making, even though I was vegetarian and vegan, even though I was physically active and I did a lot of meditation and yoga and all those things, I could still make better choices in every direction, still make it even better. And it doesn't stop. We can still continue to make choices. And the more we make in a more conscious manner, the more we can see and think clearly and act clearly. And so it becomes more obvious and more simplistic that you can continue to do that, and it will continue to get better. And that's what, you know, I'm certainly experiencing, and Alan experiences along with me because he's making the same choices, so we're doing it together. So there you see, you have two people living together. We're doing the same things. We're living the same life together, and we basically have done that from the moment we met. He came from a totally different background to me. We have totally different blood types. He smoked from the age of 10. He smoked, was smoking cigarettes. He had, as a young man, he was beer and smoking and so on. And I'd been brought up in a very somewhat healthy and reclusive way, if you like. I never had any of those things, and not that I wanted them, but, I was a much cleaner lifestyle. So there was complete opposites. We came together, made the same decision at the same time, and to go raw vegan and to, do everything on a more conscious level. And here we are, 17 years later. And throughout those 17 years, we've experienced the same changes in our body and our thinking and our spiritual outlook. We've experienced the same changes, and we've come to, now where we're on completely the same level with everything that we do and say and think and act. No difference. So it doesn't matter where you come from, what your, situation is, nor your blood type. Like, Alan has the most common blood type, I have the rarest blood type. And yet, we can still have the same results from making those choices, same choices.
Mm-hmm. Well, coming back to the breast cancer business, in this context, I think we should thank a pioneer who passed away a few hours ago, and that's Louise Hay.
Oh, yes.
Oh,
I didn't know.
No, you didn't know.
Oh, no, I was not aware.
She was 90, and she passed away this morning.
Oh, really? Oh, wow. What a wonderful person she was to share, as she did, her own experiences and how many people she's been able to help.
Well, I think she sold something like 30 million books.
Yes.
And, well, I think we owe a lot to her.
Absolutely, we do, yeah. She helped me. I mean, at the time, I was looking for every kind of information I could get from anybody that had done anything other than what was being offered. And, yes, I mean, all her, she had
not
her books
personally.
And, through her books and her different, her videos, and I still have some of her videos in the original form, of the old video style. Setting up her publishing company so that others could publish the books. It was a fantastic, wonderful, wonderful woman.
Well, what she taught us is every illness, every sickness comes for a single reason, and it's reminding us that our lifestyle is unnatural. And so it's no use treating the sickness. It's you have to correct your lifestyle to save yourself.
Yes,
and
absolutely.
In the case of cancer, obviously your lifestyle is less than desirable. And I think the main thing she taught us is every part of your body represents different things. If you have breast cancer instead of bone cancer, that means there's something wrong with the breast. The function of the breast, for example, is to nourish. So you fail to nourish other people. You are over anxious regarding nourishment. That you know, or you fail as a mom, something like that. I read her correctly.
Yeah.
And well, I think this is a very important message which she left us. And in fact, in my teachings, my courses, there's a particular session on this.
Mm-hmm. Yes, and I think too, the whole from the nourishing side of things, yes, certainly that's what the breast represents, is perhaps a lot of people are not nourishing themselves well enough as well, not only from food itself, but, you know, self-love. And I think that Louise Hay also brought that about, that information too, of caring not only for others but for yourself in a big way. Certainly there has been over the years a big move with a lot of young women towards not breastfeeding their children, and I think that's a huge mistake. Clearly, that's what we're designed to do, and that's, you know, getting that the right nourishment from the right milk, in other words, your own mother's milk, is the best start that anybody can have in life, and that, you know, that can take us into a whole other sphere of discussion. But certainly, you know, having milk in any other form is going to be deficient. Not only deficient, but if you're getting it from certainly cow's milk, you're getting it from another species that milk is designed for that species' baby, not for our species, and it's going to cause major problems and has been causing quite clearly. That's just, you know, from a health point of view. From the ethical point of view, that's a whole different story, but there is absolutely no reason for us to be having milk from another species. We're the only species on Earth that does that, and we're pretty much the only species that are in serious state of ill health.
Well, you know what? Hong Kong used to have a world record of breastfeeding.
Oh, wow.
You know, only 14% of our babies got, you know, breastfeeding for, I think, 6 weeks. Can you imagine that? Now, the good news is it's much improved.
Oh,
it's much better now.
Yeah.
But then we have another world record, which is terrible news, and that is cesarean delivery. Mm-hmm. And I think more than half at one point, up to half of our babies came through cesarean.
Wow.
Now, that's another story. But I think we should thank Louise Hay and Jeanette for, you know, telling us the truth.
Yes.
Reminding us that, you know, there's hope with cancer, and there's always, your fate is in your own hands. Now, in our next episode, which is next week, Jeanette will be describing to us how she managed to regain health and what can we do. And I'm sure many of us would like to know what can be done outside the mainstream medicine world. Well, so thanks for being with us in the past hour, and we'll be back next week. Cheers.
Bye.